Welcome, welcome from Alpha, from Alpha to Omega.
Hello, and welcome to the 72nd episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Tuesday, the 1st of November, 2016, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. After a long, unplanned hiatus, I'm delighted to welcome back Michael Roberts to the show. Michael has a new book just out called The Long Depression: How It Happened, Why It Happened, and What Happens Next. We discuss the main theses of the book, the idea of a long depression, the problems with Keynesian accounting identities, the hopes for a capitalist revival, and the chances of a total breakdown. But before we get into all that good stuff, I have a few people to thank. First of all the monthly subscribers: Faraz K, Christopher W, Sean L, Jesse L, Jeffrey S, Ambrose A, and Alexander W. I must also thank the once-off donations from Daniel CM and Lawrence M. Thanks a billion, everybody. We also have a few new YouTube subscribers: PamA546, Todrianth, Mundo Tezo, Tom Carpenti, Samuel Wanyoike, Soviet Funtime, EK Pyro 666, Sean P. Ryan, Martin Fabris, What's the Crack Glushton, Justin Wagner, Brave CD14, Martin LA, Sid Sin, The Talk Watcher, and Bob Morey. Also, a major thanks to the new iTunes reviewer, Dirty Mexican Commie. Right then, after all that, let's try the interview. Michael, you've got a new book out called The Long Depression: How It Happened, Why It Happened, or What Next. Can you give us a general overview of what the book is about?
Well, Tom, it covers a lot of things, but the main message, and perhaps might be new at least, is to say that since the end of the Great Depression, the global financial crash that we had in 2008, when all the banks went to the wall and had to be bailed out by governments around the world, followed by a very deep economic slump where national outputs in the major economies fell by 4 or 5%, and of course in some of the weaker ones like Greece even more than that, a recovery took place of sorts after the middle of 2009. But what the book's saying to you, this wasn't a normal recovery. We were in a completely different situation than the normal boom and slump that capitalism, in my view, exhibits and has exhibited over the period of its existence. And we can identify since, say, the 1945, several recessions in the US. But this was different. Instead of recovering back to the old rate of growth, or say 3% a year for the major economies, and people coming back to full employment, or at least where they were before, and incomes being restored, what happened was that growth remained well below the previous level. Employment improved, but unemployment is still higher than it was before the crash, and average incomes in many economies remain well below. In fact, there was a figure by the McKinsey Institute which recently showed that since the average incomes of Americans in 2015, from what they got from work or from savings, were no higher or lower than they were in 2005. That's 80% of Americans are in that position. And two-thirds of the people living in the top economies have found that their incomes are the same as they were 10 years ago, from work or from savings. That's the state of affairs that's resulted since the end of the Great Recession. So this period of slower growth, poorer employment growth, weak income recovery, I've called a long depression, and tried to show the similarities, as I do in the earlier chapters of the book, between that and the Great Depression of the 1930s and an earlier depression, the first Great Depression of the late 19th century, which hit the United States and parts of Europe. This depression, of course, covers a much wider range across the world, and not just in a small number of capitalist countries in the late 19th century, or even the Great Depression of the 1930s, which did spread elsewhere. So the book is saying, here we are in another depression, like we had in the depression of the 1930s.
So this idea of having, say, your wealth, sort of the normal person being, say, the same as it was 11 years ago, in real terms, that's kind of an unprecedented kind of thing for modern capitalism.
Indeed it is. Normally we would see a gradual improvement in the real incomes of the average person over, say, 50 years. Of course, not in a straight line. Mainstream economics would say, look, doesn't that show that capitalism is successful? People's living standards have improved. They've got more things in their homes, and they have better services and all the rest of it. We're much better off than we were 100 years ago on average. Well, that may be true for a sizable proportion of ordinary people, but it's never been in a straight line. Over the lifetime of the average person or household, people have suffered severe drops in income, loss of jobs through slumps and setbacks in the capitalist economy. And so capitalism does not move in a straight line. It moves in booms and slumps, ups and downs. And so for a sizable section of the minority of the population, things have never got better. In fact, if we look at America, we can see that the average income, medium income for American households has really not risen since the 1980s. And the share of income going to labor, that is those of people who work, compared to the total amount of output in the economy, has drastically fallen, and the share going to the owners of capital and profit has significantly risen. As we know, Tom, there's a lot of evidence, and we've heard about it all, about the huge inequality that has risen over the last 30 years, both in wealth and income in the major economies, and that's one of them.
So we have these different schools of economic thought. How did they explain what happened in 2008 then?
Well, as I try to argue in the book, first of all, what we find from the mainstream economists, the official agencies of government and the central banks and so on, is that, first of all, they didn't expect the huge slump that took place in 2008-09 to come. I cite in the book how basically they fail to see this coming at all, and they also fail to explain why it happened in any real way. I cite the example of the Queen of England going to the London School of Economics after the collapse of the banks and the start of the slump in 2008-09, and she went to the head of the London School of Economics and said, can you tell me why this happened? And they couldn't provide an answer and had to go back and think about it, came up with the best statement they could. But really, they couldn't explain why the Great Recession had taken place. It was not expected amongst mainstream economics. Many economists in the mainstream thought that the dangers of depression or slumps have been solved, and that we can have harmonious growth in the major economies. Or we could manage the economy through judicious use of government spending and budgets and the operations of the central bank on the interest rate to do that. But all those policies did not succeed, and we had that huge collapse. The explanation provided by mainstream economists and others varied from it's a chance in a billion, so it was purely random, to greed of bankers, to instability in the financial system, to a lack of demand. All these things, in my view, it just described the slump. They don't explain why it happened. Why were the greed of bankers suddenly the factor which brought the economy down in the major areas of the world? Why was the lack of regulation of the financial industry suddenly bring that about in 2008-09? And why was it really just a random event, a chance in a billion, as some have argued? These are the explanations provided. And of course, because if you don't have an explanation of what happened, you don't really know what to do to fix it. And we've seen since 2009, for the last 7 years, various efforts made by governments, central banks, and so on to try and restore the world capitalist economy to where it was before. And so far, they have failed.
So one of the major explanations that we hear a lot of times from the left and Marxists left as well, the Keynesian and Marxist left, is that it was an underconsumption problem. So this is the idea that the workers didn't have enough money to essentially buy the goods that capitalism would produce and would cause a slump. Can you talk about what's kind of wrong with this idea?
Well, I think it's also an idea not just from some Marxist and leftist economists, and it's probably the dominant idea amongst economic thinkers within the labour movement and the trade union movement globally. That's the line that's generally put. But also, it really comes from the ideas of Keynes and followers of Keynes, who believe that the crisis is caused by a lack of aggregate demand, a collapse in demand, in particular demand, as you say, from workers and households who find that they haven't got enough income to buy the goods that are being produced. I think that's more a description of the slump. I mean, if you think about it, if listeners think about it, what is a slump? It's a situation where people that are out of a job, they can't therefore buy so many goods. They're struggling. It's where big companies find they can't sell the goods, and so they start to go bust. And that's the situation. So on one side you can't sell and the other side you can't buy. So it does appear to be a loss of demand. But which is the problem? How do we get into the position, a description of a collapse in demand? It's really a description of the slump. It doesn't really explain why it happened. And that's my main criticism of the underconsumption theory, lack of consumption, is that it doesn't explain anything. The second criticism is, if you look at the evidence, Sir Tom, it's not true that there was a collapse in consumption which led to the slump. In every crisis or slump since the Second World War, in the United States at least, we can see that 1 year before that happened, consumption was bowling along at some pace, as it is in 2016 now. But what happened was business investment went down sharply, usually about 1 year before a recession started. So on every occasion, the real causal indicator of a slump coming was the fall in business investment, not a fall in consumption by workers stopping spending or capitalists stopping spending. What you had was a fall in business investment. So we need to investigate why the business investment begins to fall. And the argument in the book is presented what I consider is a Marxist approach to it, is that business investment is the key to booms and slumps. If that's going down, you're going to, over a period of time, you'll get a slump eventually, and then you'll get the lack of aggregate demand and the underconsumption following that. And the fall in business investment, it depends, and the movement in business investment depends on what's happening to profits and the profitability for the capitalists to invest. Because under a capitalist economy, what matters is not producing things that people need or services that they require, but whether it makes a profit. And therefore, if profits begins to fall, business investment will stop as well, and that will lead to the lack of consumption. That's the order that we need to look at to understand what is going on.
Now, on the Keynesian side, maybe the post-Keynesian side, they have these accounting identities, which are simple equations that basically describe all the flows or of an economy. So profits and taxes and government spending and consumer spending and all this. They seem to use these equations to say that the problem is with consumption and that it's an investment that drives profits and not the other way around. What's the problem with this?
Well, anybody who's got a little bit of smattering of mathematics, or if you like, logic, knows an identity means that if I say A equals B, that's an identity, A equals B. But it doesn't tell you whether A causes B or B causes A. So what the Keynesians do, they present what they call a macroeconomic identity, and that they say in an economy, all the savings made by households and by capitalists equal all the investment. You can't have more investment than saving at the end of the day. So S equals I, savings equal investment. Fine, okay, but which way is it? Is it that investment creates the savings? So if we say, for example, that savings are only made by capitalists. Workers spend all the money they get from their wages, so they don't have any savings in an economy. So all the savings, for simplicity's sake, come from profits. So are we saying that investment causes profits, or profits cause investment? The Keynesians, using their identity, actually conclude that profits come from investment. In other words, that the capitalists decide to invest, workers decide to spend, and therefore you get profit. Now, it seems to me that's back to front. That's the wrong way around to understand what's going on in a capitalist economy. Capitalists don't invest for just to produce, they invest to make profit. So what decides their level of investment will be the level of profit. Therefore, how much they've managed to get to save from what they have sold after paying workers' wages, what Marx called the surplus over and above the wages that workers have got. So that's their savings, and that's what decides how much they will invest. If that goes down, they will invest less. So the Marxist way of looking at it is to say, well, what drives investment, to use the Keynesian identity, is savings or profits. The Keynesians say it's the other way around. In fact, by using the word savings, they hide the true nature of the capitalist economy, which is the drive to make profit and the exploitation of labor to create profit. Under the Keynesian identity, you see no profit at all. It doesn't appear to exist. And therefore, you don't really know what's going on in an economy.
It seems to me that identity, that accounting identity, is a kind of a vast oversimplification. That if you were to break it down into, say, each I or each S, so each bit of savings, you probably need to show, you know, what year these savings came from, or where does this profit derive from? Does it derive from work done this year or work done a previous year or investment? And that in reality, you probably have a vast time series, a vastly complicated one, to actually get an idea of causality, not just an identity now that doesn't take into account, is this profit from last year's investment or 30 years ago investment or wherever the hell it's from? Does that make sense?
Yes, I think that's right. I think you've got a situation where I think listeners should try to grasp it in their own minds. It's not a difficult thing to grasp that investment depends upon the past profits made by capitalists when they put workers to work and employ machinery to produce things and services to sell. And so investment is driven by past profits.
And perhaps not even just the very most immediate past profit from this year, but profits over a long scale.
Yes, because investment builds up. So you don't, when you buy a big piece of machinery, the usefulness of that machine and its operation doesn't end in 1 year. Also, it may cost way more than you can possibly afford in 1 year. So you have to, if you're a company, you have to borrow money to pay for the whole thing, or to pay for it in partial bits, because that machine could last 25, 30 years or 10 years. And that, so the cost of that machinery has to be depreciated over several years. So that's built in to the initial investment cost you're making, what we call a capital stock. And so what you've got then is you're not just making profits on, say, if you buy a potato and convert it into chips. So the cost of potatoes plus the cost of the workers converting the potato into chips is your cost. You also need a frying machine and a place to fry and all the rest of it. So the result is that you have a lot more cost than just what what your cost is for buying the potatoes. So the overall accumulated investment is what you have to measure against profit. And that rate of profit is what capitalists find starts to fall. If it starts to fall, then they're increasingly in a difficult position to continue to invest.
So now we have this problem now of this kind of what you call the long depression. What role does debt play in this long depression?
Well, it's, I think, the most other important factor that we've got apart from the question of profit. In the book, I argue there are two reasons for the Great Recession, two fundamental reasons, and for crises in capitalism, but particularly the Great Recession, and also two reasons why we remain in the Depression. First is that there was a, the rate of profit for the major economies, the capitalist sector of the major economies, began to fall prior to the Great Recession. And this has been a phenomenon which I outline in the book. It goes up and down, the rate of profit, but it's been secularly falling since the post-war period. And from about the end of the 20th century up until the Great Recession, those last 7 years, it was struggling to, it was near post-war lows, despite some improvement just before the recession. But the other reason why there was a little bit of improvement was there was a massive increase in borrowing and the raising of debt by corporates and households in order to keep the economy going. So we saw what we saw as a huge credit bubble, mainly expressed through the purchase of property, homes and so on, but also in other sectors. So we had a huge ride in debt, particularly corporate debt and banking debt. And that debt eventually was unable to be serviced because of the fall in profitability and had a crash. And a lot of that debt went to the wall. This debt, in other words, didn't represent, after all, anything real. What Marx calls it was fictitious. The capital that it was purchasing was fictitious because the debt didn't represent real values in the economy. And so we had the collapse. Now, since the Great Recession, a lot of that debt still remains. The IMF only last month published figures to show that the level of debt in the world economy now stood at 255% of world GDP, whereas just before the recession, it stood at half that. So despite the Great Recession, which should have cleared away a lot of this debt of being written off, and despite that, there has still been a massive increase in the debt. That includes debt the governments have had to run up to bail out banks, but also debt that companies have continued to make because interest rates are low. So they have been borrowing more, mainly not to invest, but to buy back their own shares and keep the value of the stock market high and give the appearance that everything is fine and dandy. So the result is that we have a situation now where we still have quite high debt, particularly in the corporate sector, and we still don't have a significant recovery in the profitability of capital. So those two factors are holding the world economy down and keeping it below the potential to grow on even on a capitalist basis. What that tells me, unless we can get less capitalism can get its profitability up and get its debt down, we will continue with this long depression.
With interest rates this low, what incentives is there for a reduction in debt?
Well, not much. That's the problem. You get a situation where this environment continues. First of all, lots of companies are carrying on because they've got low interest rates, so the debt they've already got they can finance by doesn't cost too much to finance it and service it. So they, although they're not particularly making any profits, they can continue to service their debt and keep their creditors at bay. We call those companies zombie companies. They don't grow, they don't develop employment, they don't invest, but they survive. At the same time, we have very large companies who don't need, not who are raising debt, not because they particularly need it, but because they can then hoard their cash and put it abroad to avoid paying tax, or to buy their own shares back to make this make their stock market shares look high and give incentives to their chief executives and also give the impression that they're doing well. And so we have a situation that's artificial, fictitious. We have credit continues to pump in to the banks. The banks are prepared to lend at virtually nothing. And and speculation in the stock market and even in property markets again continue to rise. But the real economy, that is production of new of goods that people need and services that they have, remains at relatively low levels in growth because profitability in those sectors remain low. So we have a divergence between the productive sectors, which matter for improving our living standards and everything, and the unproductive sectors, which only matter for the speculation of the wealthy and the rich. This divergence cannot continue indefinitely. And that's why the danger is, the risk is increasing now quite sharply, that we'll have to have another slump before all this can be cleansed away.
Why is the increase in debt before the crisis? Why did that fuel a boom? And the increase in debt we have now, why is that not fueling a boom like it did previously?
Well, it's fueling a boom in the stock market and in the bond market. They're at record highs. Most stock markets, or at least the American ones, are at record highs. The bond market, which is a very important market for listeners, what that means is that either companies or government, rather than borrow directly from the banks, they issue a bond, a promise to pay back. That bond is gives an interest to the owners of that bond. And also, because there are continual because there's a lot of bonds out there, and people want to buy them because they're safe compared to investing in the real economy, the result is that the prices of the bonds are rising all the time. So people are making money out of buying bonds and then selling them on, speculating in the bond market, buying shares and selling them on, speculating in the stock market. So, and because it's cheap to borrow at virtually zero, this boom continues to take place in financial assets and to some extent in property, but not in the real economy. So there is a boom, but not a boom in the real economy. That's the divergence that we've seen since the Great Recession.
So in essence, you're saying there's been an additional build-up in fictitious capital that we have yet to see realized.
Indeed. Yeah, as Marx's phrase, fictitious capital, which for your listeners, as I say, means investment not in the real economy, not in productive assets, not in producing more things and services people need, but investing in things like stocks and shares and bonds and in loans, giving the appearance of making profit, but in reality not making anything that's real. And that divergence is what we see at the moment, which creates the conditions, if the real economy is not improving, for another serious crash.
Now, just some interesting statistics that are in your book here. This one struck me, was that every major capitalist economy has 30% more capacity than it needs to meet demand. Like, surely a stat like that must have a big impact on how much investment is going to be done by corporations.
Yes, it does. Now, I think that's a stat, which mainly an American one, but also you can get it for other countries, which tries to measure the total amount of available potential output from all the machines, equipment, factories, employment that we've got in an economy, and then measure it against the actual output. So you've got a difference there. And there, so in other words, the capitalist economy, say in the United States, could be growing 30%, could increase by 30%. Than it's doing at the moment if it was growing at full capacity. Of course, that's not strictly true, because perhaps some of the capacity that we're measuring here is no longer useful to anybody. Maybe the factories are too old, the equipment's too old, and cannot be, and it's not been written off. And so it's what some economies call hysteresis, that actually the capacity is lower than it looks. And indeed, the capacity available has been reduced, because after such a long period of recession and depression, much of the available equipment and plant and machinery and so on can't be used. But nevertheless, there's no doubt about it. Throughout the history of capitalism, there is this unused potential output, not only in equipment, but also in workers sitting idling by for capitalism, because as far as capitalists are concerned, they're not going to put all that to work unless they can get a profit out of it. And if profitability is low, then they'll let it lie fallow. That means, of course, they also won't invest in new equipment unless they're forced to, because other capitalists are doing so. And that's the competitive pressure. But on the whole, it means lower investment, because there's still a lot of capacity that could be used up there, as you say, and is still just left idle.
So let's think about what could cause an increase in investment. Could it be that by the time a lot of this equipment basically becomes unusable, the capitalist class might be enforced to invest, and we might see just an uptick just from depreciation, essentially?
Yes, some people are saying that. They're saying that if we accept that actually this spare capacity doesn't really exist, and if employment that is really more or less close to full employment. The official rate of unemployment in the United States and the UK at the moment is about 5%. Probably unofficially, it's a lot higher than that, because there are lots of people who are working part-time, temporary, and so on, who would like a full-time job but can't get it. So they're sort of underemployed. But even if we accept that for the moment, then the argument goes, well, we're pretty close to being fully employed. Workers have now got some bargaining power to ask more wages. Capitalists will have to pay them more because they can't find another source of employment, employees. So wages start to rise. That will squeeze capitalist profits. The only way around that, traditionally, for capitalists is to start looking for new equipment which can shed labor at the extreme, a robot that replaces the labor altogether, or a machine that reduces the amount of workers it requires to get the same or more output. This process of technological development is precisely the capitalist process to replace labor with better machinery that's more profitable. That's the argument that's going to happen. So we will begin to see that process happen over the next few years. I would say, well, it hasn't happened so far, and the evidence seems strongly against it. If you have if you have rising wages that start to squeeze profits, you're going to get further falls in profitability. The capitalists are in a difficult position, even if they haven't really got any spare capacity and they've written everything off, which they clearly haven't on their books yet. The more likely scenario is that we get a recession or a slump first to cleanse away this excess capital and create conditions to use the new technology that might be available down the road. So it's not going to happen with a nice harmonious process of more investment, because wages drive capitalists to invest more, and rising wages drive capitalists to invest more, and therefore we get more investment, therefore we get more growth, everybody gets more wages. That's the harmonious model of capitalism. It certainly doesn't seem to have existed in the recent period, and I think the more likely scenario in the next 1 to 3 years is a major slump rather than that.
Another interesting stat here. It says that in your book that a quarter of all US workers make $10 an hour or less. That's quite a dramatically poor wage.
Yes. Now, what it tells you is, of course, in the history of capitalism, there's always been a sizable section of the workforce that is receiving the barest level of income from going to work. They possibly don't have any particular skills which would give them an advantage in the labor market or education. They're not in professional jobs or the ones that all pay more. These are generally people who are doing unskilled work. Often, I was reading just today that something like 26% of American workers work in unsociable hours from 10 p.m. at night to 6 a.m. in the morning at any one time. So there's a massive number of people working in low-paid work, often overnight, uncongenial surroundings, because they have no other way of making an income. Now, how can they live? Well, they live because then it's not just them. Maybe they've got two or three other people in the household doing similar work to raise income. Maybe they hold down two jobs. Some people do at less than £10 an hour, going from waitressing to security work at night and so on. These are the way that a whole layer of workers at the bottom end of the income scale have to try and survive, perhaps topped up to some extent by government benefits where that exists, food stamps and all the rest of it that we know about in the States and in Europe, to provide a little bit of extra income to survive. But that is the nature of the capitalist work process for a sizable section of the population.
So I was wondering if we could talk then a little bit about what the world rate of profit might be. You see in the book that JP Morgan said that before the crisis, it was about 9% and it fell back to 4%. And now it's back up to 8% but falling again. Is this a Marxist type rate of profit, or what is this statistic?
Well, JP Morgan probably isn't. They've probably looked at there are several ways of trying to measure the rate of profit. I won't bore the listeners with all the technical details, but first of all, just to remind the listeners that the vast majority of mainstream economists are not interested in looking at the rate of profit, whether it's for the world or for any particular country, because they don't consider that relevant to what's going on in the economy. Marxist economics tells you that it is, because profit is relevant to investment. and the rate of profit, the profitability that capital can make, is a key indicator of the direction that capitalism and the health of the capitalist production and what direction it's going in. We can measure national rates of profit, at least in some of the major economies, reasonably well, even from a Marxist point of view. There are different ways of measuring it. JP Morgan probably measure it from corporate margins. So what they do is they say, this is the total amount of value created in an economy from sales of goods and services. This is the amount of wages that are paid. We can work out what the total amount of profit is, and we can divide that by the total amount of production, and we get, as it were, profit per unit of production. And that's our marginal estimate of the rate of profit in any one economy. And they've probably done that for several countries and come up with a figure which is an average of all that. So it's a marginal rate of profit, if you like. The Marxist way of looking at it is different. You would, first of all, add up what we were discussing before, all the value of all the assets that the capitalists have got in machinery, plant and equipment that they've built up over maybe quite a long time. And that's a cost that they continually have to take into account when they're making profit, plus the cost of employing a workforce. And then we see what sales that they've got, and we deduct from sales those two costs, and we get a profit, and that we measure against the total investment the capitalist has got. And we can do that for various national economies. As for a world rate of profit, the concept is this: a capitalism is a world system. So although we have barriers to the movement of labor, as we know so well, and barriers even to the movement of capital, investing abroad and so on, trade barriers and all the rest of it, so we don't have a world economy. We have nation states with all kinds of barriers between them, so that we cannot, as it were, bring about an average rate of profit for the world by adding up all the assets of the world and seeing what all the profits are of the world and coming up. But what we can do is take a range of national rates of profit and average them out and weight them out and make a, gives us a guide to what the world rate of profit is. And why would we want to do that? Because capitalism is increasingly a world system. It's globalized across the world, and therefore each country, each national capitalist state, is now increasingly dependent upon the other. If the United States goes into slump, the rest of the world will. But increasingly, if other countries go into slump, they can bring the rest of the world down as well. So we have an integrated capitalist system. So we'd like to see what the world rate of profit is, if we can measure it. So in the book, I attempt, among others, who've also attempted to do that, I give the data on where the world rate of profit is and which direction it's going. And it gives us an indication of where the world capitalist economy is going over the next 5, 10 or 15 years.
So I remember seeing some research done by, I think, a guy that you use some of his work. Is it Esteban Mito?
Yes.
An Argentinian guy. And he had done long-term rates of profit for, say, the British economy from, I think, like 1800.
Yeah.
And when it starts off back in 1800, it's like 45% or something like this. And it goes all the way back to, I think, to the late 70s, and actually goes negative and it bounces back a bit, but it's still now really quite low. And we see the over this kind of a long empirical evidence of a falling rate of profit. A question I have for you about this is that even though we have these crises that manage to cleanse the system somewhat and it'll cause the rate of profit to regenerate, it still always looks like it's kind of one of these asymptotic curves that's heading towards zero.
Yes.
Like, so what do you make about this? I think there is a Marxist who had some kind of breakdown theory called Henrik Grossman. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about this and what do you think about it?
So first, let me tell you that Esteban Mito is an Argentine Marxist economist. Looked at 14 different countries going back to the 1850s and worked out the rates of profit for those countries from the national statistics available. And that included the UK, as you mentioned, which, by the way, the UK has very good data going back to 1855, provided by the Bank of England for us Marxist economists to work this out. And then he did an average of the world rate of profit from that. And as you say, Tom, I produced a graph in the book from his work, which shows how the rate of profit has fallen from, say, 40 plus down and down and down, but not in a straight line, for these economies. So you could say the world rate of profit has been in decline, and that vindicates Marx's law of the tendency of rate of profit to fall on capitalism. He's saying that as capitalism expands and capitalists compete with each other to try and raise their profits, they expand their level of investment in machinery and equipment as opposed to labor. And because labor is the only force that actually creates value and profit, that tends to lower the rate of profit over time compared to the cost that the capitalists have made. They don't intend that to happen, but that's what happens as they all compete with each other to raise profits. So Marx's law says that there's a tendency for the rate of profit to fall. It can be overcome. It can be overcome by crises, which you've just talked about, but also by exploiting the workforce harder, by finding new markets to new areas of the labor force around the world to exploit, and by introducing technology that's very cheap, keeps the cost of machinery down. All these factors and others, including what we talked about, fictitious capital, can help to keep the rate of profit up, but the tendency is always driving it down. And Mito's data shows that that's the case. It has been falling over the last 115 years, not in a straight line. Now you say, well, does that mean it's going to zero? Well, the answer to that is that, and Mito explains it in his paper, which if I've got the reference in the book, so if you're really into it, you can have a look. And he says, well, every time we have a slump or a recession, it shifts the rate of profit up again, and it changes the trajectory of the fall. So you can make a sort of mathematical exponential figure for when you get to zero. So if you were in 2000, you wouldn't get to zero on the current rate of fall, on the average rate of fall, to 2050, he says. Now in 2015, you wouldn't get there till 2075. So, but each time you go further down, you're getting closer and closer, but you never quite get there. It's like a disappearing horizon. Because, of course, the rate of profit can be shifted up for a period of time through the factors I've just described. So it will be a mathematical, it's only a mathematical projection when you talk about it going to zero. In reality, it would continually be shifted away from reaching that zero point in time. And anyway, just think about it, you could have, to get to that point would require, before you get there, you'd have major crises amongst the capitalist economies. Just a little fall in the rate of profit and the mass of profits in an economy or a set of major economies can cause a major slump. And that is the situation that we're likely to see well before you got towards zero, if that was to happen. And now, you mentioned Marxist economist of the 1920s, Henryk Grossman, a Polish economist, who tried to analyze Marx's law of the tendency of rate of profit to fall to show that it would inevitably lead to a fall in the rate of profit, and that the fall in the rate of profit would create conditions for crises. Now, some people say that, well, what Grossman was really saying was that capitalism is going to break down when the rate of profit gets to zero. And so he's got a rather weird breakdown theory that everything goes to zero and then capitalism collapses forever. Well, if you read Grossman's book, that's not really true. What he's saying is that the rate of profit has a tendency to fall and will fall. There are counteracting factors, and he spends several chapters discussing them. But as the rate of profit falls, eventually it will lead to a fall in the mass of profit. That's the total amount of profit in an economy. And when that happens, that's when you get a slump, and the capitalists are finding that they can no longer even get more profit by investing more, let alone keep the rate of profit up, and they don't want their own living standards to suffer, so they stop investing altogether, and and the situation of slump appears. Now, that you can call that a breakdown, or you can call that a theory of crises under capitalism. I don't think Grossman was saying that capitalism just breaks down and that's the end of it, but it does show that, and Grossman does that very well, shows how the law works and how it impacts upon profitability and profits, and how you get these series of booms and slumps within a general decline in the profitability of capital over time. The highest profits and profitability are found in those economies where capitalism is still developing the productive forces, like in China or in the emerging economies, as they're called, and the lowest rates of profit are in the more mature economies like the United States and the UK. And Mito's work shows that's the case. The rate of profit falls as economies get more mature and capitalism goes in decade after decade into developing around the world.
Did Grossman write his book before volume 2 and 3 were readily available to Marxists?
He wrote the book. Volume 2 and 3 were available, but most Marxists didn't read them. So Grossman had read them. If we look at the history of Marxist economics and how it was applied after the death of Marx in 1883 or the death of Engels in 1895, you'll find that Marx's Volume 1 of Capital, which next year celebrates its 150th year of publication, it's 150 years ago next year when he published it in 1867, was the only really available theoretical part of Marx's collected works. The rest was lying in bits of papers in his study. Engels then spent several years editing and finally managed to publish the Volume 2 and Volume 3, as they're called, of Capital, his subsequent works. In Volume 3, for listeners want to know, is Marx's theory of the law of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall spelt out, although there are mentions of it in Volume 1. He'd already written about it in the 1860s. It's just that it wasn't published until well into the, just before Engels died. So we have the Volume 3 of Capital, which describes this profit argument, is available in the 1890s. But most Marxists and those active in the movement, although activists in the labor movement internationally, particularly in Europe, didn't really read that. It was still in German and wasn't really available on a wider scale. And so Grossman is one of the few. By then, the Marxist economists and the leaders in the Marxist movement had developed theories like underconsumptionism, we talked before, as an explanation of crises. Grossman was one of the few economists who returned to this work and developed it clearly to explain what Marx's theory of crises was, not the theory of underconsumption or other theories that were bandied around at the time, but could be related much more directly to Marx's law on profitability.
So this idea then we have empirically that we see the rate of profit falling and declining to a low ebb at the moment. For capitalism to ever, say, escape and get back to the heady days of capitalism, it would require an enormous crisis for that to happen. So it seems like we're kind of destined to stay in some kind of low growth, low profit, I don't know what you would call it, not a sweet spot, but some kind of a period of low growth and low profitability. And it's the fact that if we had a crisis that was big enough for to reboot the system to its glory days, you know, that would have to be such a politically kind of cataclysmic event. It's God knows what would happen.
Yeah, you're right, Tom. I mean, there is no permanent crisis, Marx said. So you can't assume that this low growth, stagnatory environment with low profitability will continue forever. On the contrary, as you say, capitalism needs to recover from this. It has to recover from this. It can recover by a slump or a series of slumps that recreates a new level of profitability, which then gives the incentive to capitalists who are remaining and surviving in that situation to invest in all the new technologies which are now available and are just being applied, robotics, artificial intelligence, all ways to raise profitability and increase production, the productivity of labor so much more efficiently by shedding labor. All those measures, plus a new expansion of globalization, would be possible with a higher rate of profit. But that will require a slump or a series of slumps, which could be pretty significant. Now, in the book, I describe that is a possibility, that will be, if there's no change in the way in which the world is organized and working people do not gain power to democratically introduce a different mode of production than capitalism, then capitalism can overcome this crisis at our expense with a series of slumps and reestablish a period of growth again, and that, as they have done in the past. In the long depression of the late 19th century, and it was a long one, from 1873 to the early 1890s, nearly 20 years, with booms in that, but then series of slumps. It was only after that that conditions were created, after 20 years, for the major economies to have a degree of expansion and a rise in profitability. In the Great Depression of the 1930s, the profitability was only returned around when war began. A Second World War began, which dramatically drove up profitability for the capitalists who gained profits through military production rather than civilian production, and also gained profits dramatically through holding of wages and the forced savings that workers had during the war, and created conditions with the new technology after the war and the massive availability of labor in Europe and Japan and elsewhere to have a very high level of profitability in the post-war period of the 1950s and 60s. That, so you could say, that either it'll take 20 years of slumps or a major world war that could create conditions for a new capitalist boom and higher profitability. That's a gross and horrible thought, but that's what we face. And it demonstrates, it seems to me, that capitalism is really reaching the end of its road. It's past its use-by date. That's one of the chapters in the book to describe the conditions it's in. Mito's data shows that profitability remains low historically. That shows again that capitalism has a transient nature. It can't go on forever. And even if it can overcome this crisis, then that will not end crises. We'll be then, after a period of boom, that all the whole process of Marx's laws will begin to operate again. And yes, you say it's horrible. I mean, can we imagine another world war? I don't think so. Therefore, I think that's unlikely. But can we imagine slumps and nothing done about them and capitalism recovering from them at our expense? Well, that's a possibility.
Well, that very depressing note, Michael, thanks very much for coming on the show today.
And thank you for having me.
On this episode, you heard the theme tune, The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters, by Sun Ra and his orchestra, and you're now listening to Whitney with No Woman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you join me for the next episode of From Alpha to Omega. And remember, please like, subscribe, share, tweet, or leave a review. It really helps spread the word about the podcast.